kind of discuss it. Like one of the ways that protein aggregates impact the health of the cells is through the mitochondria. So how do the mitochondria change with age? And kind of what are the driving factors that push them?
So again, it's a complex matter. I mean, in the sense that mitochondria are very complex and dynamic organisms, and they, let's say, what happens normally, the way that they maintain homeostasis is that they are constantly generated and replaced, essentially, depending on the stimuli and the metabolic inputs that they get and the needs of the cells. So, and again, as I mentioned also before, the way to maintain mitochondrial homeostasis is either through generating new mitochondria, so mitochondrial biogenesis, or mitophagy in order to clear damaged mitochondria. And also mitochondrial dynamics are very important for this, because essentially mitochondria can be either fragmented and become like more isolated and so on. And this is when they, for instance, can be taken up if they are damaged to be degraded by mitophagy, or they can be forming very extensive networks to actually improve or become more efficient in terms of metabolic function. So this normally works very well, and it's very dynamic, and they can adapt very quickly in a youthful or healthy status. However, over time, what happens is that due to the decline also, or in the other pathways that take care of things like mitochondrial clearance, loss of, you know, let's say autophagy or other pathways that should be taking care of reducing the damaged mitochondria, and the fact that also mitochondria function in terms of generation of the energy, so the balance between the different complexes within the mitochondria that would generate ATP becomes altered due to, again, alteration of protein synthesis, reduced mitochondrial biogenesis, and so on, then the mitochondria start becoming also, let's say, less function in terms of generating energy. They may generate perhaps more ROS and more oxidative stress, and they tend to accumulate also, so because they cannot be removed any more efficiently through mitophagy during aging due to the decline in this process. And so what happens is that you tend to accumulate dysfunctional mitochondria, which then in turn, you know, they can start generating damage also within the cells, right? Because if you have essentially more oxidative stress and let's say less energy generation and the inability to remove this mitochondria, essentially there will be that's when essentially problems start occurring, because then you get an influence on the other hallmarks as well. So these hallmarks are all connected, right? So that's where it becomes important to maintain homeostasis. Yeah.
So how do we encourage mitophagy?
So there are several genetic pathways that modulate and mitophagy. I mean, in terms of, you know, essentially that can be also stimulated through, let's say, nutrient sensing. I mean, there is and the involvement, for instance, of phosphorylation processes that sense and detect damaged mitochondria, and then they stimulate the ubiquitin proteasome system essentially to remove this. So they tag the damaged mitochondria, and then they recruit the ubiquitin proteasome system in order to get rid of them. Pharmacologically speaking, there is, I would say, people are actively looking to ways to specifically target mitophagy, but I would say at the moment, perhaps one of the molecules that I think it's very well known also in the supplement space and so on is urolithin A. So that one, it's a natural molecule. It's GRAS recognized as generally safe. It's been already used in humans a lot by, essentially it's been discovered in my ex lab at EPFL in the OVERX lab, and is now being used currently in, by companies to do clinical trials. And that one seems to very strongly promote mitophagy in several tissues, and in particular seems to work pretty well for brain and muscle. So preclinically speaking, with some initial evidence now going for muscle aging in humans. So that one seems the most promising at the moment. Yeah.
Okay. So with our mitochondria not behaving very well because they're being stressed, if it's in muscle, so then we get like sarcopenia. So if we start off, what is the root cause of sarcopenia? And actually, I thought that sarcopenia was essentially, like, if you're sedentary and you get old, you will eventually get sarcopenia because your muscles just waste because you're sedentary. Right. But is there some is there some external cause? Is there something else that would force, that would make sarcopenia happen?
Yeah, so sarcopenia, yeah, so it's a bit of a complex answer in the sense there are multiple possibilities, in the sense that, yes, in theory, you know, we would all think, oh yeah, if I don't exercise at all or if I'm too sedentary, I would normally develop sarcopenia. But it's the same as dementia, right? So if you think you would never exercise, you know, your brain in like thinking or doing, being busy with tasks and so on, eventually you would think like, oh yeah, if, you know, everyone should develop dementia. But there are, in fact, yeah, people that still are resilient to that. And essentially you have to think of sarcopenia as a sort of continuum from the decline of muscle function as we age. So sarcopenia is not just, let's say, losing muscle mass, it's also losing strength and the ability to do daily movements that are impacting your quality of life. So essentially, there are these three, as I mentioned, three clinical readouts, so grip strength, lean mass, and gait speed, which are indicators collectively of sarcopenia. So if they go below certain thresholds, and these are guidelines that have been established worldwide by different consortia of clinical experts, that's where you are below a certain threshold, you're considered sarcopenic, right? So it's really a continuum from your muscle aging up to a point that you are really physically impaired in your daily life. But that means that essentially sarcopenia, it's a worsening, or if you want, or it's a impairing condition from the muscle aging per se. So it's still associated with muscle aging. And there are several, let's say, factors. So in that sense, the same hallmarks of aging or muscle aging are also important for sarcopenia. And as I mentioned, NAD is significantly reduced in biopsies from sarcopenic individuals. Mitochondrial dysfunction is occurring during sarcopenia, even compared to muscle aging. So you may get a decline of these metabolites or these pathways in muscle aging, but in sarcopenia, it's even more pronounced. So you really get like a significant decline in these functions. And that's some of the things that probably contribute to the worsening of the condition.
Right. Clinically, I guess it's, but you also see like these protein aggregates building up.
Right.
Do they build up more in sarcopenia, or we don't know?
We don't know. I mean, I would say the simple answer, we don't know yet, because I've seen them in muscle aging preclinically, and we have seen them in also in primary muscle cells from healthy humans, healthy elderly humans, or inclusion body myositis, which is a disease characterized by protein aggregates within the muscle, which is also associated to impaired overall health and quality of life and muscle health, but is not necessarily considered sarcopenia. So it's probably measured clinically by different readouts, and it has this as a biomarker. People really use this protein aggregations. But in sarcopenia per se, I believe it would be probably the case, but it would require some validation there.
Yeah. Right. Now, you did in vivo, or somebody, an in vivo study has been done with like NAD precursors, which have shown reduced, I guess, protein aggregation in muscles,
right,
in mice.
Right.
Is that correct?
So that's one of my studies. That was one of our studies in Cell Reports in 2021. So what we observed, to perhaps, I'm not sure if I should say to our surprise, because we know that proteostasis collapses in aging, but the fact that we would be able to look at different, you know, muscles in mice, and then also even things like simpler models like C. elegans, and even primary muscle cells from taken up from muscles from young or healthy elderly, and then we would look at particularly amyloid formation, so one particular part of the proteostasis collapse, we really observed a strong enrichment for these amyloid seeds within or oligomeric structures within the cells, right? So within the muscle cells. And so that was kind of surprising to us, because it really compares, or seems to compare to some extent, to what people would establish for diseases like inclusion body myositis. So we did a little bit of this comparison, and then we saw that indeed, preclinically speaking at least, the use of NAD precursors may ameliorate the formation of these aggregates, or may improve the clearance. But clinically speaking, there's no study that is looking at this yet.
Right. So just out of interest, you were using NR, what kind of dose with the mice?
Oh, so with the mice, yeah. So normally we use about 400, for chronic studies, we use about 400 milligrams per kilogram per day. So we put it just in the chow diet of the mice. So the mice actually feed on their food pellets and they take an up NR. we have done this also. I think many people have done that for, we use always the same range. I mean, people have also put it in the drinking water. That seems to work as well.
Yeah.
And that's true also for NNM, for NAM. I mean, people either put it in usually in drinking water or gavage. It's another way to do intragastric administration, or you put it in the food pellets. But the range is always between anything between 400 milligram per kilogram per day to as low as perhaps if you gavage, where you get one direct bolus of the compound, as let's say 1 or 5 milligram per kilogram in mice. So we have done this also for our, all our studies with NAD precursors.
Yeah, 400 is towards the top end.
Yeah, so that in humans, yeah, to give a bit of translational insight, I mean, that to humans would correspond to, yeah, almost or quite close to about almost 2 grams per kilogram in a human. So that would mean kind of very high dosage, because in that sense, for humans, I mean, NR, all the UA, all these supplements that have been approved as from the GRAS, that have the GRAS status, usually they are considered up to 1 gram per kilogram in a, or 1 gram per day in humans. But actually for disease conditions or age-associated conditions, so there are some trials that are starting to go with higher doses of NR at least or other established precursors, because that seems to bring the best efficacy. So maybe in conditions where you are really physically impaired, you may as well take a little bit the risk and try to get something meaningful in terms of clinical efficacy. And this, of course, needs to be then tailored and leveled for healthy elderly, or even for people that are healthy but just want to supplement for increased performance and so on. And here also comes a lot, what would be very, very important would be, of course, you know, precision, so personalization of these supplementation strategies, which people are studying. I mean, also at NUS, people are very, the work of Andrea Meyer, she's very interested in getting to a point where we can optimize supplementation for people already, even if they are just healthy seniors or healthy overall. But that would be also something that needs to be understood, and it will take some time in order to understand whether this could actually improve the clinical efficacy in the long run.
Yes, the whole precision medicine thing would be a very interesting topic to dive into. I don't suppose you have like sedentary mice and mice that exercise. I mean, do you know whether exercise will help reduce the protein buildup in muscle cells?
Well, I think that would certainly be, I don't know if there are studies specifically looking at how exercise would improve protein aggregation. We know that exercise has been linked even to improvement of neurodegeneration. So to the in rodents, at least, I mean, and even in people which have dementia, I mean, usually they recommend exercise, because essentially you improve bioenergetics at the systemic level, and the muscles also can essentially stimulate, I mean, the production of exerkines, so molecules that can have systemic benefits, and even stimulate the brain to actually generate new neurons even. So through essentially signaling pathways that are activated following exercise. Now, whether there is in muscle that leads to specific removal of aggregates, we do not know yet. I mean, or at least I've not run these studies, but I would not be surprised if that's the case, because then essentially you put back in place the wall balance between the need for muscle to generate new proteins to maintain muscle mass, and the you're generating also more, essentially forcing mitochondria to generate more energy in order to support the muscle exercise. So that would probably kind of reactivate the wall homeostatic process.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so lifestyle is always a good way to address these things, if at all possible.